Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic. I have ADHD. My pronouns are she, her. And if you could get prosecuted criminally for killing plants, I would have been given the death penalty long ago.
Hi, I'm Violet. I have ADHD. My pronouns are she, her. And I don't want a green thumb, but I do want the ability to reach into the ground and pull up a turnip with a face on it, like Princess Peach does. I would prefer that. I think that's, I would prefer that to a green thumb.
Really?
Yeah. It just sounds fun. Like,
have you eaten a turnip?
No, but imagine I could pull up a,
yeah,
I could
they're just not great.
Plunge my
they're
hands
not
at
great.
The ground and then have a friend to talk to.
It has a face. It has a face.
It has a face.
Okay.
When you say it like it has a face, I don't know.
Yeah,
it sounds less cool when you say it like that. But
it sounds horrific. So today's episode is not about that. Today's episode is about permaculture and food forests.
Hell yeah.
So you've heard me. So for those of you at home, we moved here to Minneapolis about 2.5 years ago. And starting last year, last growing season, I started the process of probably annoying the neighbors by killing the lawn and turning it into a food forest, because I would like every available square inch of this very, very small front and backyard that we have to be doing something helpful to the environment and to the people that live here. I am an amateur permaculturist, but I wanted to know, do you know what permaculture means is?
I'll be honest, you've said the word a lot since you started working on the garden in the backyard and in the front yard. And I think I looked it up at one point because I didn't know what it meant, but I have forgotten. So I'm going to say I totally know what it means because I love you. But I'm just going to say, for the sake of the episode, oh, I don't know. I forgot.
I kind of figured you did not know what I meant when I said permaculture. And I was like, I kind of specifically want to dump about this to Violet.
Honestly, you know what? That's totally great. Not because I don't already know all of this.
Not because you don't about it.
No, but so the viewers or the listeners can really be up to speed on what permaculture is. All of the intricacies
because
that I know already.
Permaculture, it is meant to be a regenerative system that leaves the earth better than you left it. It is often credited with being founded by these two Australians, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, in the early 70s. They wrote a book about it that came out in 1981 called Permaculture One. Like the name suggests, it's permanent agriculture.
Oh,
it is defined as, yes, it is defined as consciously designed landscapes, and this is the important part, which mimic the patterns and relationships found in nature, while yielding an abundance of food, fiber, and energy for provision of local needs.
And if you're someone out there who thought it was like permanent culture, like something that does not leave the cultural ethos, like JNCOs, like those really long jeans,
yeah,
you're wrong. It's not what it is.
It's not
it. Get out
it.
Of here.
That's not it. Yeah.
Actually stick around so you can learn what it actually is.
So for a lot of us, when we think of farming, we think of the European idea of farming, where you have rows, you till the soil, you plant a bunch of one type of plant. We think often of monoculture, where this is my cornfield, this is my wheat field, this is my soybean field. That is not how many, many different people from many different continents, including this one, used to do their farming. And there's a better way. Permaculture is a regenerative system. Modern monoculture is fucking up our soil. It's fucking up the nutrients in our food. It's fucking up the resources that wildlife needs, like local fauna and pollinators. Capitalism has made it so that the idea of making sure the farming we're doing isn't hurting the earth is not even in the back seat, but it got left at the gas station for the sake of higher yields and bigger food.
You mean to tell me that growing millions upon millions of acres of exactly one thing, corn, in the United States is not good for the environment?
Believe it or not, it's not.
You're blowing my mind. It's not. That's insane.
It or not. Yeah. Yeah. And there are ways where it's, you know, these methods have really hurt us. Like, there are fewer nutrients in a lot of the food we eat now, and we're trying to help fix that with science. But what if there was a way to make the soil more nutrient dense so the stuff you're growing was abundant and delicious and helped everyone and helped the earth? So while there are many ways to do permaculture, the one that I think people are most familiar with are food forests. And I'm going to talk about food forests at the end here, kind of to tell you my, to dump at you about my big plans for our yard so you can understand what I'm doing as I do it. Yes. And it'll make you say, oh, and that's why you did this. Oh, and that's why you did that.
Which is just acting because I totally already understand.
Because you everything. Totally already understood all of it. You're already in my head.
Yes.
So I was made aware of this concept during my Indigenous Studies classes for my minor in anthropology, which tells you that Australians, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, did not invent permaculture.
Huh. I mean, I think they just coined the term, I assume, right? Like,
they coined the term. They coined the term and they popularized the concept. But
gotcha.
This is one of those things where Indigenous people had been doing things for a very long time, and then a white dude comes along and says, have you heard about communism? Have you heard about anarchy? Have you heard about a hierarchy of needs? Yeah. I could go on things that it's white dudes have gotten credit for that are actually Indigenous knowledge. That they're like, no, we've been doing this for a wicked long time, y'all. So, before we look at the concept of a food forest, I want to look at some ancient examples of permaculture and food forests that far, far precede these Australian dudes who have done really great work. Not to discount the work they've done to get more people into permaculture and realizing they can do this to their own yards, but still, all of this work was done by Indigenous people of the past.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, are they trying to like take credit for inventing this way of farming, or are they saying that this is the way Indigenous people have done it for a long
time? I haven't read their book, so I don't know. I have not read their book.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully it's the latter, but I do not know. So historical farms pre-European colonization looked a lot different than what we think of when we think of a farm. I'm going to take you on a little global trip to look at some ways people have been doing permaculture. One of the oldest places, one of the most well-studied ancient permaculture, I don't even want to say experiments, but the legacy of these experiments is in the Amazon. Terra Preta de Indio might be one of the oldest examples that we found, and how even today we have better soil, us earthlings, in the Amazon River Basin because of what these pre-Columbian indigenous people did to the soil.
Interesting.
Even today.
When we're talking about permaculture, and I know the concept is that essentially this works better with the way nature wants to work. It's healthier for the environment and everything. Can we have like naturally occurring permaculture, or is this specifically a concept for something that is human made?
It is not. Okay, so you are mimicking what nature does already and doing that more.
I see. Understood. Wow. So in the Amazon, we literally are reaping the benefits of the work done by people hundreds and hundreds of years
ago. Pre-European. Thousands.
Thousands. Wow.
Thousands of years ago.
Jeez. Goodness. Yeah. That's so cool.
This area is one of the most studied. And they changed the soil in the Amazon River Basin for the better by basically composting all over the whole goddamn place.
Love it. Yeah. Makes the soil better. I know that.
They added biochar, which are the carbon remains of burning organic waste, which is really common because that feeds back into the soil. It helps keep the soil from getting compacted. It helps lessen the acidity of a soil where it's needed. A lot of great stuff. I've looked at getting biochar for our shit. Back then, they were like, this burned matter is good for the soil and good for what we grow. They would use old broken pottery as part of their composting. Yeah. It is just more dirt. They're feeding it back in there. They would use food waste and bone to put on the forest floors. So they layered it let it, yeah, they layered it. And then they were doing this, and this is where permaculture happens. They said, okay, we throw all of our old organic stuff on the ground because the trees are doing the same thing. The dead animal feeds the soil when it falls to the ground. These leaves, when they fall to the ground, feed the soil and build up the soil.
So
these dead plants end up feeding the soil. We're doing the same thing. So this is permaculture is nature does this and it builds up the soil and helps things grow. We do the same thing.
Interesting. So what did they do with all their styrofoam cups and cigarillo wrapper packages?
Ate them.
Oh, got it. Okay, understood.
They needed the microplastics. Oh, they were hard to come by.
Got it.
Yeah. This soil was so productive. And it is a rich, deep, earthy black. Like, it is very rich soil there. The soil was so productive that historians had to actually alter their initial estimates for the population of the Amazon River Basin pre-European contact because the area could support more food growth than they anticipated. So estimates are that, and it's a big window, but 8 to 20 million people inhabited this region pre-colonization.
Sheesh. Wow. It boggles my mind to think of, like, how many generations of humanity it took to figure out these things to where they were doing it consistently enough to where we can see now, thousands of years later. Mind-boggling.
So now we're going to take a little trip, head over to Africa. Specifically, Tanzania. So in Tanzania, on the south side of Mount Kilimanjaro, the Chaga people have built comprehensive and well-studied agroforestry systems. So agroforestry is sort of a branch or a concept in permaculture that involves using planted trees and shrubs and the intentional addition of livestock to help manage your crops. So the trees are part of what help you manage your crops. You grow things that aren't necessarily perennial. They're things that you plant them once, they grow, you get your fruit, they go to seed, they die. You have to plant them again, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They don't come back. They would grow those things in these agroforestry systems they built, because the trees would provide shade for plants that needed shade. They would be windbreaks to keep high winds from blowing things down. The leaves would fall and create a mulch to help retain moisture in these areas so they don't have to irrigate as much. It would provide shade for the livestock, who would help eat weeds, who would then shit that help feed the plants.
How did they make sure that the bounds of their individual farmlands were respected so that Monsanto didn't get mad at them for planting outside of their farm plot?
Right?
Yeah. No, that's amazing. So they're literally just using the environment in the same way, essentially, nature does, right? The same way that these plants have evolved exist.
They saw, hey, the places where these trees are, there's not as much wind. The shade is nice. These plants grow well. Let's plant these trees ourselves to do the same thing.
Love it.
So these Chaga gardens are called Kihamba. And your average Kihamba, which is a home garden, by the way, this is just a thing normal people do. It's not for, like, mass production. Your average Kihamba contains several types of coffee, fruit trees, including 25 different varieties of banana, and all of those things are beneath the protection, all of the things beneath it and the protection of those trees are things like beans and vegetables and root crops like yams and taro. You have all these fruit trees helping protect all of their annual crops that they're growing. And provide the perfect environment.
I'm hyped. This is fucking awesome. I'm just imagining. I haven't seen images of this, but the way you're describing it, it's so hype in my head.
So
I'm imagining just walking through the woods. You got like a big old basket, and you're just grabbing some beans, and you're grabbing some bananas, and amazing.
Yeah, and as you can imagine, a lot of people who are interested in permaculture nowadays are autistic. The Venn diagram is not quite a circle, but it's creating a system. It's creating a closed system that functions in on itself.
Yeah, you love a good system, and I appreciate that too.
Yeah, and permaculture is about doing your best to mimic the systems that nature already has in place, or to observe the systems that are already happening where you live and help contribute to those cycles.
I love when I learn about a concept that is taking something that is so thought to be just the way you do it. I don't even know what the term for that is, but like culturally ingrained. You say, hey, what if you do it this way? And it goes, oh yeah, that makes way more sense. Why have we been doing it this way? I love learning about stuff like that.
With these Kahamba gardens, they use dense planting also. So something you may have noticed, you may not, is how much more densely I've planted things this year. I don't know if you've noticed. It's like,
I did. Yeah.
It's all packed. And that's on purpose.
It's funny. I noticed that, but I didn't want to say anything because I had thought it was a mistake. I thought like we had messed up somehow. And I was like, wow, there's a lot of stuff really packed in the garden. I hope stuff's okay. You know what you're doing.
It's intensive planting. And this is for the home gardeners out there. The spacing on the seed packets is a lie from Big Seed to get you to buy more garden bed. Don't listen to the spacing recommendations. They're liars. These Kahamba use dense planting, which is something I am trying to do in our garden this year. And they typically cram over 500 banana plants in an acre.
Wow. That's a lot of banana plants. And for the record, by the way, our garden this year is popping off way more than it did last year.
Yeah.
Significantly, even though it's more densely planted. So like there's definitely something to what you're saying, clearly.
All of the shade that I am providing the soil by densely planting things is helping it retain moisture better. I'm having fewer weeds that are trying to sap nutrients from the plants I'm deliberately trying to grow.
We've got more mushrooms.
We have more mushrooms popping up because I've created more shade in the garden beds. So with Kahambas, planting intensively and really densely means that these gardens can thrive without external fertilizer inputs. You create this closed system of carbon, basically, to say, yeah, we can regenerate and keep doing this over and over and over again. Not a thing is wasted. No space is wasted. We're mimicking nature. Everything's going to get fed. And we don't have to go buy a bunch of fertilizer to go do it.
Amazing. I love that.
So then we're going to come back here. We're going to go to the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, fun.
This one is extra special to me because I have hiked through some of these places. TLDR, I lived in British Columbia for a few years. This is one of the most recent like confirmations we've gotten of food forests in our neck of the woods. So like I said, I learned about this concept in my Indigenous Studies classes. So the most recent confirmation of food forests we've gotten here in our continent was back around 2021 when historical ecologist Kelsey Heralda Armstrong of Simon Fraser University, I nearly went to that school.
Oh, cool.
If you watch Battlestar Galactica, you've seen a lot of Simon Fraser University. She identified village sites near Vancouver and a couple village sites closer to Alaska where local tribes were violently forced out by colonizers in the late 1800s. So 150 years, no one has gone to go mess with this land, right? Mm-hmm. No one has gone to go cultivate it. No one has gone to go do anything to
tend
to it.
Till the soil and add fertilizer or pesticides.
Nothing. No one's done anything. At those sites, Armstrong found there were densely packed patches of edible plants that did not match the density and diversity of other areas of the forest. So these areas of the forest where there were all kinds of things, like really densely planted patches of Pacific crabapple, salmonberry, which gets a shout out in an upcoming Murphy Bay Magic episode.
Oh, fun.
They would have salmonberry bushes, hazelnuts, wild cherry, Pacific yew, wild hawthorn. And when she looked at areas kind of near here, but not specifically next to those village sites, there is nothing of the sort. No densely packed edible local flora. These were anomalies, and they were still densely packed with all of these edible plants still.
You know, this reminds me of something. I had gone down a bit of a rabbit hole recently. I think I was watching a video about a perfectly preserved or almost perfectly preserved human body that was found in the ice somewhere. And when they were looking at this body, they did a lot of examining and like to try and figure out where this person came from, because the place that they were found was very far from any known civilization. So they were trying to figure out, okay, how did this person get here? Where did they come from? They looked at the contents of that person's stomach to see, okay, these are the foods that were in their stomach. There were things like what is that spiral vegetable, or what's it called?
Fiddly fern.
Fiddly fern. Thank you. There were things like fiddly fern and all kinds of other things in their stomach that they realized must have come from this one other area. And I remember thinking when I was watching that video, that would not work on modern day humans in the future, nope. Right? Of course, people had to do permaculture back in the day. If that was the way you had to do it in order for it to work, you had to survive on it.
It's also quite literally easier than doing it the other way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's work smarter, not harder. So even after the inhabitants of those villages, which were, from my understanding, all coastal Salish people, I wasn't quite able to find if it included other tribes, but these coastal Salish villages, all these people were violently removed from their homes over 150 years ago. But the areas of these forests still show their presence, which positively affects the local wildlife, like pollinators and bears and stuff, today. It still has notably better soil quality and more diversity of plants today because these people messed with the land, which I think is great. Because there's like that eco-fascist narrative of like humans are the disease and like us messing with the earth is somehow bad. But this shows that when we are thoughtful stewards of the land, we can improve the places we live long after we're gone, which I just think is extremely punk and very romantic and very cool. That's really my goal, is this little place we live long after I'm gone. I want somebody 100 years from now to go, wow, I really enjoy this apple that I'm having in this apple tree that we grew in our yard. The soil here is so great. Wow, I love how many things were growing here. You know what I mean?
Like, Yeah. Because like imagine, you know, 1,000 years from now or 2,000 years, somebody goes, this one little patch of land up in what used to be Minnesota is like really healthy for some reason. What's the deal with that?
The work I do could help feed some future human that I've never met and could never meet.
There's a part of me, if you are a longtime Info Dumpies listener, you know that I'm a big fan of people like Woodsy Owl and Smokey Bear and stuff like that. And I feel like this is very much in line with their thought processes, right? The thought processes of preservation. But in a more true sense, I think, than those were even originally, those characters and those campaigns were initially thought of. Woodsy Owl says, give a hoot, don't pollute. This is like a step beyond that. It's not just don't pollute. Yeah. Don't just make it worse. Make it better. And I love that.
Yeah. And like there are aspects of permaculture, too, that people are even discussing for carbon sequestration to help with greenhouse gas emissions. Like it's really cool. And BC, it's funny because European colonists who went there were perpetually confused as to how the folks were feeding themselves, because in their eyes, they saw no agriculture. And they saw people who spent a lot of time chilling and working on like other domestic tasks. And they're like, they're not working out in the fields all of the time. How are they all so well fed? Work smarter, not harder. They were doing their work. They did it and they were done.
They were existing alongside nature and supporting the nature that they live alongside.
They were working with land rather than attempting to bend it to their will.
There might be some people listening who might be hearing all of this and thinking, oh, this is a logical fallacy. This is an appeal to nature or appeal to history or whatever. You know, I really don't think this is that, because there is literally evidence that the soil in those areas where this was evidentially done is healthier and more robust.
It's helping the entire ecosystem. I could do a whole episode just on global food forests, just honorable mentions. The Maya have managed multi-strata home gardens with layers in Mesoamerica for over 3,000 years. There are the sacred Kerala Kavu groves in India. There are the Pekarangan home gardens in Indonesia. Humans all over the world have been doing some version of mimicking nature for their gardens for millennia. So the way we're doing it in modernity, it sucks. Like, monoculture sucks, but it is more work. It is more effort.
Yeah. It only makes sense under a hyper-capitalistic mindset, which is where you need, I am a seller of corn. I need to just grow corn and kill anything else that tries to grow here. That's the only way this makes any sort of sense.
Modern permaculture, there are so many. I'm going to name the three ethics of modern permaculture, and I'm going to name some of the principles. Depending on who you ask, the principles are different. Depending on who you ask, there are extra ethics to it. There's extra stuff. These are the ones that I discovered when I was learning about permaculture. So I'm going to talk about those. So any reply guy who wants to tell me on Spotify, why didn't you mention so-and-so and such a thing? Fuck off. Go touch grass,
whoa.
Actually.
Whoa. Yeah. Go coexist peacefully with grass in a healthy way.
Go kill the grass in your front yard. Go kill the grass in your front yard and go plant local grasses.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Go plant native local grasses. Yeah. So modern permaculture has three ethics. There's care for the earth. Makes sense. Nature is the model for permaculture design. The natural option above all else to help restore natural systems. Doing it organically for the benefit of the soil and sustainably so the soil is better for generations to come. The second ethic is care for people. Permaculture's goal is to produce things for human well-being. Food, fibers, medicine, and pleasure is even noted. So if you just like how the thing looks, if it is delightful to have that local flower, that native plant growing in your yard, great.
Permaculture.
And the third ethic is share in the surplus. Once basic needs are met, surplus is shared with another system, someone else doing a permaculture system of their own, or another person. Me, when we had that abundance of mushrooms, telling you, hey, ask the neighbor if she wants some mushrooms.
Yeah.
Waste is an asset to be repurposed, like the sticks in our yard that I said, don't bundle those up for trash. Don't bundle them for the trash man to take. Because our next big garden purchase is probably going to be a wood chipper, because I'm seeing that that's probably going to be something very handy. Yeah.
Like
trying not to purchase
one.
A whole hell of a lot of stuff, but it makes sense. Modern permaculture has principles. There are so many classes and certifications you can take about permaculture design. I have not taken them. I've just read a lot. I'm not interested in taking them. Some of them can be quite prescriptive. Much like veganism, a lot of them are like, you're doing it wrong, you're not one of us, is kind of the vibe I get. I don't have time for that. But there are principles. Before I start with the principles, planting native plants and perennials is always one of the core things. Those should be the cornerstone for your permaculture design.
That makes sense.
Permaculture principles. The first one, observe and interact. Before you ever break ground on stuff, you need to recognize the natural patterns and relationships in this area of land you're trying to work with. Our first year here, we got here a little late for me to do stuff for the growing season, but I spent most of that growing season just paying attention to where the sun went in the yard, where water tended to pool, where the soil was eroding. I was paying attention to those things and planning and taking notes about when does it get warm enough to go put plants out? When is the first frost? And that's when I kind of decided what I wanted to do the following growing season. Observe and interact is something you should always do because nature changes, climate change is changing, what I can grow here. And you need to continually observe after you've started working on your food forest or whatever type of permaculture you're doing, to look at drought, stress, plant disease. What kind of pests are you getting? I notice the places where we get dandelions growing because that says the soil health is not great. Not that the dandelions need to go, but those are telling me, hey, the soil here is kind of shitty. We love growing in shitty soil.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
all around Minnesota, there's all these areas where it's just like tons and tons of dandelions. And then there's areas where there's no dandelions whatsoever. And I was like, I wonder how it decides. Shitty soil. Huh. Interesting.
Yep.
Is it just like low in nutrients or like really sandy?
I believe it's low in nutrients. I forget exactly what conditions dandelion enjoys, but I noticed where there was dandelion growing in our yard. I was like, okay, I may do something about that at some point. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So observe and interact, always doing that. Number two, catch, store, and cycle energy. So this includes human energy. The less that you have to put in effort for this system and the more nature can handle it, the better your permaculture system is doing. The more you can take off of your plate so you don't have to do as much active gardening, the better your permaculture system. So you use natural energy to reduce the amount of human energy needed to work in the garden. One thing I'm looking at is creating swales for rainwater that helps disperse it out into the yard and slowly absorb into the soil rather than pooling certain places. And that can kind of add to irrigation. Water catchment systems. So next year, probably the big project I want to do is a rain barrel, to see how we can manage that, look at design, see what regulations are for rain barrels here, and a way to use that to passively irrigate the garden. And I want to get solar panels, maybe even build a solar dehydrator, which is just a big box with a lot of black paint and metal in it to help you dry your harvest. A lot of things to make it take less effort to garden and to use the energy you have. So some people will have a pond where you can have, you know, rainwater run down into that pond to catch the water and then have that pond feed off into an area that has plants. There are all kinds of things. When people who have more property can get really fun and experimental with this. We just have our little house in the city. Permaculture principle number three, relative location. Placement of things in your garden should be for ease of management. Having chickens near the compost pile for people who have chickens. Chicken shit goes in compost. It's easier to just scoop it directly into the compost bin. If you have an open compost pile, chickens will help eat some of that stuff and get rid of some stuff. Like, it just makes sense. Stuff you're going to be harvesting regularly, being closer to your house versus farther. For us, this isn't as important because we got a little city. We're doing a little urban permaculture. Yeah. For people who have big property, yeah, you don't need your orchards right up, balls up to the house, but your herb garden, you probably do. Principle number four, stack functions. The more jobs that a thing you've done in the garden can accomplish, the better. Someone might, like, if we weren't someplace that got so cold, I would probably want to do a pond. I would probably want to have fish who just live a happy life in that pond and have the water filtration partially be done with some plants. And that can help feed stuff in our garden. You can have a, you know, there's, I think it's called a Belgian fence, where you can use certain fruit trees to help build a natural fence. But it's also fruit trees. So the maple trees in our front yard, I didn't plant those. Those are probably 100-year-old maple trees. They're very old. Those maple trees provide shade for the front yard, where I just planted currants, which are a berry that needs shade. And those are perennial. Those are going to come back every year. But next year, when I decide which vining plant I want to add to our food forest, that vining plant will attach itself to the maple trees there. So the maple trees are providing leaf mulch, they're providing shade for the currants, and they are providing a structure for the vining plants that I'm going to put in the front.
Oh, and I don't know if you saw, but one of the plants in the front yard, I think this is the raspberry bushes. I know we had one that immediately started doing great, and then the other one, we thought it looked like
it was dying. Back.
It's coming back. It said, I like it here. Okay, I'm good.
Oh,
I'm good.
Never mind. I'm done freaking out. I freaked out for a minute and almost died. I'm doing good. Yeah, no, most of the green's coming back. I'm pretty shocked.
Yeah.
So, number four, stack functions. Number five, stock the most important functions. So basically, have backups for your most important things like water and soil amendments. So for water collection options, someone might have a cistern and a pond, might have, you know, heavily mulched soil to help retain water. You can have multiple options for soil amendments. So like for us, we have our keyhole garden, a compost bin, we add mulch, we add leaf mulch, we're rotating crops. The next thing I'm going to do is start getting into doing cover crops. All of those things help amend the soil. When fall comes, I'm going to collect so many leaves, so many fucking leaves, and do leaf mulch, which again is amending our soil. And like the principles of permaculture state, I'm going to see about taking someone's excess from their system and putting it into ours, and I might be having you go pick up some llama and or rabbit poop for me some point in the future to add to the compost.
I was going to do it anyway because I love you, but now I understand why you're going to have
Now you understand why. It's nothing weird, just for garden. Yeah. Number six, use and value diversity. A diversity of crops helps the soil health and helps prevent disease and pests. You can plant different varieties of the same plant. So we have three different types of kale growing in our garden right now. I plant nasturtium because the seeds and the leaves and the flowers are edible. The whole thing is edible, but it is a helpful trap crop that many harmful pests will choose to munch on rather than the things that are really my high value things like my peppers. So in each bed, there's an edible and a trap crop. I have calendula growing for both medicinal value and for pollinators and because it's cute. So you have a diverse number of things growing. It helps. Most of the beds there also have some sort of pungent herb growing and something that flowers to help attract pollinators and help detract pests that won't like, you know, sage and cilantro and stuff. Yeah. So number seven is optimize edges and value the marginal. In nature, places where different bioregions butt up against one another is often the richest ecosystem. So our keyhole gardens do this. You create more edges, and on those edges, more mushrooms can grow.
Like a pan of brownies, the edges are the best part.
Yes, 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 yes. Like the raised beds we have also create edges that the mushrooms really like. I'm going to be working with the edges of the shade of our maple trees to plant some other trees out front that can hang out sort of in that border region.
If you take away nothing else from this episode, remember this: nature loves edging.
Nature loves edging. It's only natural, baby. So number eight, you talked about edging, and it says use small and slow, which sounds very sexual, but it's use small and slow solutions.
Permaculture sexy, Brian. What can I say?
It is very sexy. Number eight, use small and slow solutions. Try things on a small scale before doing something big. I tried out the small berry bed in our backyard before getting more berries to put in the front. We did a small patch of mushrooms before expanding to trying logs and inoculating more of the yard. And then next year, I want to try a single rain barrel to see about a larger scale rain collection system for the yard. Just dip a toe in, just the tip. Don't go balls in until you know. Nature changes. You don't know how it's going to work. Number nine, creatively use and respond to change. Nature is unpredictable, and you need to be able to change your plan and move with it. This has helped my perfectionism a lot because there's so fucking much that's outside of my control here that I'm more like, okay, ADHD, let's figure out a solution when something's changed. So I've changed my plans as I've seen how the first year of our permaculture experiment have gone. Like the logs near the house, I thought I found a good spot for doing inoculated logs for mushrooms. Doesn't seem like it is. I think I figured out what the issue is. Those logs are going to get turned into mulch to help our garden beds and to help build up the soil and feed the other mushrooms I do have. I'm going to have shade for my rhubarb because I realized that that area got way more sun than we got that first year because it was a very rainy first year. When I planted my rhubarb, it turned out, oh, that was maybe not the best spot. I'm going to be after... you know, our first couple of years realizing what a fucking menace the squirrels here are. they're going to get a hazelnut tree, so maybe they'll fuck off and let me have some of my other veggies.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. And I love that the solution is not deter the squirrels. It's give the squirrels something that they would prefer to eat so that we can have our stuff. Yeah, I love that.
Which is a native plant that will provide more shade for other things. So it's doing a lot. So principle number 10, produce no waste or create closed loops. This is hard to do in an urban setting, but I'm trying. There's no carbon left behind. So for us, that looks like we make mulch out of the leaves in fall. We use all of the cardboard we have for compost or killing areas of grass or feeding my mushrooms. Our, you know, compost is very robust. I'm thinking about getting another one of those easy composter things. We got worms. We got lots of worms helping us out. I want us to be such a thing that we have nothing wasted. So just trying to feed as much back into the garden as possible. And then the final principle, 11, design interconnections among elements. So companion planting, fruit tree guilds. Fruit tree guilds are the things you plant around fruit trees. So that a fruit tree guild would include plants that attract beneficial insects that help protect the tree, trap crops to help the bad insects that do get near there have something else to munch on, plants that'll stop erosion to help protect the ground around the fruit tree, mulching plants that are gonna produce a lot of leaves to help keep moisture around the soil. On mature trees, like our maple trees, you can do vining plants on those. Mushrooms will grow on the mulch that you have below the fruit tree. All of the stuff is interconnected, thinking about how you can connect one thing to the next. So mulch stops weed and feeds the soil. The mycelium comes up through the garden beds and benefits our plants. It's all interconnected.
And you know, this has me thinking, last year around fall, I got the urge, because the fall here is really beautiful. All the leaves turn a beautiful reds and oranges and things like that. And I was like, I have to get out into the nature and take some photos and just walk through the woods for a little bit. And that was a really rewarding time. But this has me thinking, maybe this year when I do it, when I go out to like a nature preserve or something like that, I can try and keep an eye out for like how the plants are arranged, how these natural areas of this forest that I'm walking through are protecting each other. So
yeah,
just keeping an eye out for that so I can like learn more about how Minnesota does.
Well, I'm going to show you how forests do, because we're going to talk about the layers of a food forest now.
Oh, yay.
So a food forest aims to mimic how nature arranges plants. So first is the canopy layer. These are the really big ass, large fruit and nut trees. I don't have the space to plant more big trees here. One, because small yard. Two, because I need more sun in some of these areas than I am getting. So Sunny Real Estate, not the band Sunny Day Real Estate, but Sunny Day Real Estate is a real commodity here around our little house. So for us, our canopy layer are the big fruit trees, not the big fruit trees, the big maple trees in the front yard. And we have that one big tree that reaches over into the backyard and provides some shade. That's our canopy layer. Then you have the understory layer. This is where the dwarf fruit trees go. So we have those urban apple trees. And I think up front, like I mentioned, I'm probably going to do a hazelnut tree, which can kind of be kept like bush size but still pretty large, not as big as my bush. But
I was gonna say that the columnar apple trees that we have set up, I'm really excited for those, because it's basically just an apple tree but a little bit smaller, and it grows vertically, so it's more fitting to an urban space like this.
Yeah, I'm really excited about those. But yeah, the dwarf fruit tree is also hazelnut tree and possibly a mulberry tree for us. I need to go stare out in the yard with dead eyes for a little bit and just go, I do.
Walk without rhythm for a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When we were at Pride, James and I stopped while you were looking at one of the booths. And James goes, oh, that tree's got berries. and just growing right with everything else was a mulberry tree here. I was like, those are mulberries. Amazing. Yeah. So considering that. So first, we had a canopy layer. Second is an understory. Understory, just shorter trees. The third layer of a food forest is the shrub layer. So in our yard, this is our dwarf cherry shrubs. I have basically the smallest thing that will grow cherries, and it's not a tree even anymore. It's really a shrub. But the shrub layer is a dwarf cherry shrub. We have currants. We have raspberries. And I think I'm going to add gooseberries in the fall. I think. Those are native. So after the third shrub layer, we have the herbaceous layer. This is where herbs and medicinal plants grow, or lower growing berries like strawberries and lingonberry. Or if you're so inclined, this is where you can grow your annual veggies. So if I wanted to grow a pepper plant under my shrub layer, I feasibly could.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds really cool. I'm really excited about this. Now that I understand more about what you are actually trying to do, I'm like, oh, so much of this makes sense.
I was going to say, yeah, that's part of why I wanted to dump about it. Because I think like, oh, a lot of stuff's clicking, like the llama poop, huh?
Yeah. I'm like, okay. I see. We're trying to set up essentially a self-sustaining cycle we can benefit from.
Yes. So one, we had canopy layer, understory layer, shrub layer, herbaceous layer. The fifth layer is the rhizosphere layer. This is root veggies. These are edible roots.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably in the front growing to plant something called a purple ease potato, which is basically potatoes we can go keep digging up and grabbing. Usually gardeners will be like, you're going to put potatoes in the ground. Usually you want to do them in like grow bags or some other container you can flip over, which is how I'm growing them this year, everybody, for my annuals. But purple ease potato has been specifically bred to survive our cold here.
Oh,
and
nice.
As long as we leave some of the larger ones in the ground, you get potatoes forever.
Amazing. I love that. Infinite potato hack, everybody.
Infinite potato hack. And they're like a really pretty purple color. And then also for the rhizosphere layer of our food forest in the front, I'm probably going to plant something called skirret, which is a white tuber, kind of like a carrot.
Did you say skirret?
S-K-I-R-R-E-T.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that'll be the rhizosphere layer. Amazing. Then the other layer, layer six, is the ground cover layer. Those are low growing plants that help suppress weeds. And they act kind of as mulch and help retain moisture so the sun's not beating down on the naked soil.
Oh, like clover and stuff like that.
Clover is an excellent ground cover. Creeping thyme is also a really pretty one. Our neighbors have creeping thyme growing. I always look at it in the spring. I go, oh, yeah, you really did that, didn't you? Go off. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice. So for ground cover, I think I might fuck with some purslane, which is like a lettucey thing, but it's a waxy leaf succulent that does well here and it's peppery, and maybe just some more strawberries because those are a good ground cover also.
Awesome. And then I'm so excited.
And then finally, the final layer, the seventh layer, are climbers. These are vines. So for us, I have some seeds for something called an Everglades tomato. That is self-seeding, so it doesn't come back every year technically, but it drops so many fucking seeds in the ground on its own that those seeds survive the winter and you get new Everglades tomatoes plants. They are the Amazing. World's most nutritious tomato.
Whoa.
And because it's from the Everglades, they are so resistant to pests because the Everglades is where all of the pests in all of the United States of America go to hang out and be themselves.
So I've heard.
Yeah. I did not do great in Florida. And then for us, the other thing I think we might be growing is cold hardy kiwi,
which we can
grow here for our vining plants. Another very popular option for vines is grapes. But we will not be growing those because do you know where black widow spiders often like to let loose and be themselves?
I do. It's in grapevines.
Yeah. So I won't.
Yeah.
I don't like grapes are cool. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but Black Widow spiders, you're not invited to our permaculture.
You're not invited to our party. We have a bunch of spiders in the garden in the back helping destroy those horrible, horrible caterpillars that have been trying to eat my brassica vegetables. And I welcome them to the garden. They're not allowed in the house. In the house, they're dead on sight. In the garden, I say, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is a little like beginner's thing on permaculture. And I forget what exactly I said that I saw the look on your face. I was like, oh, she doesn't get why I'm doing that. It might have been the llama poop thing. Then I was like, I'll do an info dump on it.
But yeah, I think I understood in general why all of this was happening and like why you were doing all of this stuff. I think part of it was the composting too, because like I remember the other day you had to remind me, oh, don't throw away your used tea leaves, put them in the compost. And I was just like, right. And it's so easy to think of this stuff as useless trash to go into a landfill, when it's like, no, this is like perfectly good organic matter that would love to support a garden, and the garden would love to be supported by it. So let's use it. I love it. I get the mindset now. And I think, honestly, this will help me remember to compost things. Yeah. So.
Yeah, because it's like, ooh, the worms in the garden are going to love this.
As just a member of the house, I'm already reaping the benefits of permaculture because you made a really wicked good soup the other day out of veggies from the garden. And I was just like, I love a soup. I love a good soup. If you're not
a soup fan,
don't at me. I love a good soup. She made an amazing pot of soup using stuff from the garden. And it's like, it's so good.
James is probably going to make a pie with some of our rhubarb soon.
Oh, I love it. I haven't had rhubarb pie since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, my great-grandma used to grow rhubarb in her yard and do essentially the same thing, although I don't know if she was doing permaculture, but
probably
gardening.
Probably not. But yeah, so I am no expert, but I've really enjoyed getting to do stuff that I think makes the land here better. And there's just something I think incredibly romantic and cool and existential about, hey, how much can I benefit this land that I'm on so that, in a sense, part of me lives forever for the mark that I've put on this place that I've lived, in a very positive sense, because if you help this soil and then someone's kid 100 years later is eating an apple that was grown in the soil that you helped build up, it's kind of like you help feed that kid. I don't know. Like, it's...
No, I get
what
you're saying.
Beautiful. I am not a particularly spiritual person until it's like... Well, nature is my thing for that. Like, marveling at the beauty of nature. And, yeah.
I 100% get that. I am also not a spiritual person. Obviously, we don't have the same background in regards to spiritual things. But I completely agree. Like, I feel like... if there's anything that I feel a reverence to in a similar fashion to one might feel for religion, it would be nature. I really do agree with that.
I would encourage people, if you do have just a little patch of land that you get to do what you want with, I know that is a rarity nowadays, but if you do, I think if more people who had the capacity to do this did this, I think things would be a lot better. I think a lot more people would have food. Yes, the onus of climate change is still on, you know, the billionaires who are destroying this planet. This is not one of these things where I'm like, it's your responsibility to fix climate change. No.
Yeah.
But you can help feed your neighbors, and I think that's the coolest thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Perhaps even the best part of all of this is there's a weird parasite going around on fresh fruits and produce right now.
Yeah, the cyclospora outbreak. Don't have to worry about that for my garden goods.
Yeah, it's not our garden. I know that, so...
Yeah,
no explosive diarrhea for us.
Well, not related to that parasite, at least.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Hey, friends, it's time to thank our Patreon supporters like Bonnell Senna, Heather Watts, Nana Nussbaum, Jennifer Bosch, Patch, Harlene, Bethany, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Janice Weston, Anarchista, Percy, Nanya B, Kate Michigoose, Kate Genius, Dave Barrel, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus, Lucy, Helen Clifford, Sewing Sarah, Rachel Rachelson, Fintago, and Randy Lovings. You know the deal. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is by telling other people about the show. We don't take paid ads, so we're not taking up 30% of your episode telling you to please start a Squarespace website. And as appreciation for that, you could do us a solid and tell other people about the show. We don't pay for advertising either, so we grow entirely by word of mouth. So the more people you can tell about the stuff we make, the more Patreon supporters we get, like the lovely people I just listed, the more we can afford better software, better equipment, and honestly, just afford to be able to spend more time doing this. So you help us by helping us grow. You can post in your favorite subreddit, your favorite Discord, your favorite whatever, wherever you hang out on the internet, Tumblr. I quit once they stopped having not safe for work content on there. I liked it being a Russian roulette of, you know, am I going to see Buffy and Star Trek content or is there going to be a butthole? But, you know, people are still on Tumblr. So, yeah, wherever you hang out on the internet, just, you know, if you think someone would like info dumpies, please tell them. It helps us immensely. If you'd like to help us even further, you can like, review, rate, leave a nice comment, whatever interaction your podcatcher of choice supports. The more you can interact with our shows on your podcatcher, the more we're going to get recommended to people who like similar things as you, and new people can find us better that way also. It also helps the show look more current in the podcatcher, which makes people a little more likely to click play. If you're in a place to help us out financially, you can go to the show details where you'll find a link to the Mixnomer Patreon page. Tiers start at just $1, they go up to $10, and that is the place where you can get bonus content for everything we do here at Mixnomer. So our previous stuff, our current stuff, stuff we have coming up for in the fall, new stuff. You get all the bonus content there, and all of that money goes directly towards making the shows better, making more shows, and directly towards the cast and crew who makes all of this stuff happen. Also, in the show details, you'll find a link to the Mixnomer Discord server. I love the Discord server. Great vibes, fun times. You know, at the time of recording this, Violet last night just was working on the art for a new podcast we have coming out and just had a great time doodling with folks hanging out with her, and she had a nice time chatting and doodling. She drew a little doodle hand that kind of looked like a dick and balls, and we got a good laugh about that. But yeah, a very supportive community. Just have streams where you can hang out and interact to whatever level you're comfortable with. I love the Discord server. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.